The Saskatchewan Healthcare Coalition is hosting the All for Public Healthcare Rally in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, May 4th. It's free and you're invited. This rally is happening because our public healthcare system does not have the support it needs to meet the diverse needs of all Saskatchewan residents. For years, it has been underfunded, ignored, and hindered, so join Donna and I in person on May 4th in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan for a walk, speeches, networking, and community building. Link for more information is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. All of us in recovery have had powerful experiences that brought us out of addiction. TEDx speaker and author Adam Vibe Gunton is no different. From near-death experiences to friends committing suicide to encounters with Jesus in a diner, Adam has a powerful message, packed full of insights that Donna and I really enjoyed. But before we get into that, what's up? My name's Dan, podcaster, keynote speaker, and advocate, and this is Hard Knocks Talks, your addictions podcast. If you're interested in fostering productive conversations about substance use in your community, organization, or event, reach out to me at daniel@hardknockstalks.com to learn more about our public speaking and live onstage podcast productions. With that, let's get into our conversation with Adam Vibe Gunton.
This is Hard Knocks Talks.
What's up, Adam? How are you?
What is up, Dan? How are you? I'm great.
Good, man. I've been seeing you on Facebook like for a while, you know, and then I remember the day I saw the post where you were going to do a TED Talk and you were excited about it and you had the nice picture and the TED Talk picture. And I'm like, you know what? I've been wanting to do that for a while. And, you know, I've seen your show a couple times on Facebook. So when your team reached out to me, I was like, yes. Absolutely. Bring them on. So here we are. But before we jump in, I mean, is there anything you want to say? Is there anything you want to kick us off with?
You know, I love to connect with everybody in recovery as well. And I appreciate what you do. I've seen you guys around on Facebook and stuff as well. And I think it's awesome when people, you know, are doing everything they can to reach the addicts out there that are still suffering. And I appreciate what you guys do. And I mean, we're able to connect right now from the US and Canada minimum. Mm-hmm. And what I think is awesome, like really awesome, is we have no idea where this is going to reach. We have mm-hmm. no idea the person that's going to be listening to this that's going to need this podcast. And I'm a firm believer that every single time we share our story digitally, someone is going to hear it that had to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So speaking of stories, where do you want to get started? I mean, we brought you here to hear about your experiences. Where do you want to kick that off? Like, did you grow up around a lot of addiction and alcoholism, or what was that like for you?
No, you know, I've heard a lot of stories, right? And they say that about 67% of people that go through really tough addiction have some pretty hefty childhood trauma, right? Mm-hmm. I was one of the other ones. I was one of the ones that, you know, I got to be on a, you know, state championship football team every year growing up. I was the home run derby hitter at the Little League World Series. Had a really, really good childhood, but I was introduced to drugs when I was about 12 years old. I was introduced to cocaine and marijuana, alcohol, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, through my, you know, school career and athletics and stuff, I had this deep, dark secret. And, you know, I was the captain of our defense at Columbine High School when we won state my senior year. Yes, the Columbine High School that you've heard of. You know, and I had a great childhood growing up, you know, and then I had this experience happen my freshman year of college when I had been out drinking and partying like I did every, you know, night of my freshman year of college. And I woke up to my phone ringing and vibrating down by my leg. Mm-hmm. And I swam through the soft sheets to find my hard phone with the bright screen that read 4:47 a.m. And my best friend Chucker was calling me. And I remember having the conscious choice that I could either answer the phone like I always do with, "Hey, what's up, Chuck?" Or I could answer the way I was feeling with, "Oh, hello." Mm-hmm. And in my still drunken state, I chose the latter, to which a soft voice replied, "Hey, what's up? Why are you calling me this late?" "I was just calling to say hi." "Don't call me this late again." Mm-hmm. And I hung up on him. Mm-hmm. And he shot himself. And for nearly a decade, I was unable to share that phone call with anyone. as I bottled it down deeper and deeper with drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol were no longer a way to party and have fun. Drugs and alcohol were now my solution to life. Everything that I felt, I had to mask it with drugs. I had to drink in order to go out and talk to people, because this secret, right, that I couldn't tell anyone. And then what was really interesting was, once I actually shared that story with someone, and the first person I ever shared the truth of that story to was a street level heroin dealer. I don't know why I chose that day in 2016 to share with my dope dealer that my best friend called me and he shot himself. I did start to heal at that point. Once I started working on not having things to hide, mm-hmm. That's when I was actually able to start a process of finding recovery.
Yeah. So tell us what it was like when you found out that that had happened. Was it like a weight came on? Did it take a while to sink in? Like, what was the first reactions you had when you found out that the sequence of events that transpired?
It was the next morning. I was at my aunt's house, actually, because we were having a family party. I've got this big Italian family, and we were over there. I don't remember I think it was birthdays or whatever. And I got the call from another friend that he had killed himself. And, I didn't remember at that moment, and it crushed me. I remember cause I remember exactly where I was when I got the call, and I fell back on the ground and was laying there, and I started crying. And then, you know, it wasn't for another week or week and a half that, I found out. Because there was another friend of ours that was there when it happened, and he told me the story. So Chuck actually did it in front of somebody else. And then for the next 8 or 9 years, I actually told the story from his perspective instead of my own. I disassociated from the whole thing and started acting as if I was that friend that he shot himself in front of.
So where did the fallout from that event take you?
Well, I don't like to point necessarily at any specific event and say that this is what caused it, because I believe that when we go through addiction is the worst trauma there is. You know, when you continually tell yourself, I'm going to stop. And then the next day you pawn your TV to go shoot up. You know, you're continually putting something in your arm that you don't want to do. Like, I don't like to point at one thing and blame it all for that, because I was using and drinking before this, right? Mm-hmm. But I definitely, I had to find something. And shortly thereafter is when I found opiates, Oxycontin. That was the one that really numbed everything for me. I was prescribed 250 milligrams of Oxycontin a day when I was about 20 years old. And, you know, then when the Oxycontin runs out, you start going to heroin. You know, I'm 220 pounds right now, and I don't really go through a whole bunch of war stories. I don't think they do a lot of good for a lot of people unless they're, you know, really connected to the hope. But I can tell you I'm about 220 pounds right now, about, you know, 13% body fat. And I was 148 pounds at the end, homeless. Mm-hmm. 86 from a homeless shelter. So I was super homeless and I was unable to stop.
Almost in that.
Yeah.
So what did it then? What brought you into recovery?
A lot, bro. And I think that's the key, is that a lot of people are looking for that one experience that's going to change their life forever. Right. And I had a real intense experience that changed my life forever, but I haven't been able to rest on that experience. Mm-hmm. At the end, in the last like couple weeks of my addiction, I remember I was driving at like 4:15 in the morning, in this car that this girl let me borrow, and it wasn't stolen, but I did have to start it with a screwdriver, you know? And I came up this hill to this red light, and the car died. And then I look over to my left and there's a cop. It's just me and this cop, you know, and I look in my rear view and there's no one there. And I like open the door because I was going to push it or something by myself. Like, I definitely didn't want this cop to, you know, say anything because I'm on probation. My car's full of dope. And, you know, and then when I open the door, the screwdriver falls out on the ground between me and this cop. And then I literally, bro, I just sit back and I'm like, all right. And I gave it up to God. I was like, take me to jail, you know, if that's the only way I'm going to be able to stop. And then right when I actually had that thought, I heard somebody whistle behind me and I look in my rear view and out of nowhere, bro, someone was behind me ready to push the car and the cop just took off. A couple weeks later, I did my...
Hang on now. Unpack that for a minute. Now, there's a few things that came up there that I want to talk about. So let's just pause there and let me... So you talked to God in that moment. Were you a religious person? Like, did you grow up around religion or was this like a foxhole prayer?
I didn't necessarily grow up around religion, but I met Jesus really early. You know, I didn't go to church with family or anything like that. I would walk to church myself in my childhood sometimes. And I just knew God was there since I was real little, bro. I don't know why. But I never stopped talking to God, never stopped believing in God. It was just, I don't know how to explain it, bro. There was some kind of disconnect about giving it all to him and also knowing that he was there. Mm-hmm. Because there was times in my addiction when I would like, why aren't you taking this from me? Like, why won't you help me? You know?
Yeah.
And later on in the story, I found out why, you know, cause there were some things I had to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. So the cop got out and looked at you like, and then there was a person behind you that was going to push you. And then the cop got in the car and drove away. Like just.
The cop never got out. I promise you, it was just me and the cop on that road.
Yeah.
When I came up to the light and like, I sat back. Because I figure, like, my car's dead. Like, obviously, the cop is going to see me not move, and he's going to come back around or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, dude, I heard this person just whistle at me and say, hey, you want me to push you? It's like, yeah, thank you. And he just pushes me into this little parking lot, and everything was cool.
So, okay, so you didn't get arrested. So, but that was it? That was it for you? That was the day that you made the decision to live a better way?
Not quite. No, that's what I was trying to say is like, there's a lead up to what actually happens. And for most people, I don't know if you had the same experience, but I was trying to quit for a long time, bro. Mm. I was trying to get clean for a long time and unable to stop. I hated my life. I didn't want to be there, you know, and here I am stuck in addiction, stuck being alive, and I'm trying to stop, but I can't. But, and I keep, I don't want to say blaming God, but like asking him why, you know, why aren't you taking this from me? And it got to a point where I was sitting in a car, in that same car, and I had been going to 12-step meetings every single day. I was going to church every Saturday and Sunday. I was going to a Bible study every single Tuesday. And on November 6, 2017, it was a Tuesday. Or November 7th was a Tuesday. I had used on Monday and I was getting ready to go to the Bible study. And I had this realization that I have literally tried everything. I have tried everything there is for me to stop. And I can't keep going on. And I sat back in the driver's seat and I told God, I audibly said, I was like, I can't do this. I'm not doing this. I'm not going to church anymore. I'm not going to meetings anymore. Please, God, just let me die. Please just let me die. And I remember how honest I was when I was asking him that because I didn't want to do this anymore. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to be addicted. I didn't want any of this anymore. And when I said that so honestly, I heard a whisper, not like audibly from out here, but it was like a whisper that was right in my heart. And it said, it's time, go. And you would think, you know, that you would get excited and energetic about God saying it's time, you know, but I got angry at first because what's different about this time? What's different about this time than all the times that I've dumped all my dope in the toilet saying I'm never going to use again. And then I wake up and I pawn my TV to go get dope. What's different about this time? So I'm screaming at God in this car, hitting the steering wheel. I'm crying like, please just let me die. Please just let me die. And I'm hitting the ceiling and everything. And this is going on for a couple minutes. And then when I start to calm down and I'm breathing hard and I'm crying, and then that same voice just repeats the exact same thing and said, it's time, go. I go to the Bible study. I walk in, and you have to imagine 148 pounds, swimming in a medium shirt, haven't showered in a week. You know, I'm sick as heck. And I'm like 12 minutes late, and I bust these doors open to this Bible study. They're in the middle of prayer, and I just interrupt their prayer and drop down on my knees and throw my hands up. I'm like, guys, please help me. I can't stop. Please help me. Please help me. And my best friend, Brendan, who was leader of that Bible study, and he would pick me up and take me to coffee or breakfast or lunch. He'd pick me up from the homeless shelter, the streets, whatever. He's doing well. You know, and he comes over and he like pats me on the back. He's like, hey, bro, let's just get through Bible study. You know, like, he goes over, we sit down, and we get through Bible study, bro. And then that was where that day I did step 1, 2, and 3, like instantly. I finally figured out that I am 100% powerless over this thing. My life is completely unmanageable. There's nothing I can do within my human power. And now I believe that God's actually about to do this. So then at this Bible study, I do a third step that's sort of, you know, just giving it all up to him, right? And then 5 days later, Brendan comes and picks me up, takes me to IHOP, International House Pancakes. And I'm sitting there, I'm eating French toast, and I'm talking to Brendan. I'm all excited because I have 5 days, and it's like, it's a miracle to even have 5 days at the time.
It's five miracles.
And right, right. And then I get a text message on my phone. I open it up. I just have this little flip phone, and it's from my dope dealer. He's like, hey, bro, I just got some new stuff. It's fire. I'll give you a free 20 to try out. And right when I read it, I felt something go in through the top of my head, all the way through my body. My toes were tingling. My fingers were tingling. And then I lost my peripheral vision, and all I could see was my phone. And then my thumbs just started texting back. And it was in like King James. It was like, ye shall not text me again. Thou hast texted me for the last time. It was going crazy. And then at the end of the text, I feel that thing leave me. I was like, what the heck? And I'm like looking at my phone, read it. I was like, dude, that was not me. I showed it to Brandon. I was like, dude, that was not me. He was like, okay. And I push send. I close it. And I'm putting it in my pocket, dude. And I'm looking down at my pocket. I'm like, dude, I don't know what that was. And I look back up, and Jesus is sitting across from me. Wow. The entire restaurant had completely disappeared. All I could see was his face. There was a glow coming from behind him, a smile. And I immediately knew it was happening, immediately knew who it was. And the only thing that I can compare to that moment was when I used to shoot up heroin. It was like all the negative feelings, all the negative self-talk, all the hatred of self, all those things that you have, it all just went away. But the difference in this moment was that as fast as all those went away, I got immediately flooded with an overwhelming sense of peace, of value, of purpose, of identity. And I felt like I was going to be okay for the first time in a real long time. And I fell with my face to the table, my hand up. I said, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. And I came back up and he was gone. And Brendan was there. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, okay, I know who God is now. You know, there's no question for me who my higher power is, right?
Yeah.
And here's the thing, like I 100% believe that God has the power to, you know, miraculously take somebody from withdrawals and cravings and, you know, heal you right away, right? That didn't happen for me, bro. Yeah. I was shaking in withdrawal, like sick for weeks. And the only time that I would get any kind of relief was when I would sit down with my sponsor, who he came and got me from the Sober Living House every single morning at 6:30 a.m. We went and read this book.
That very book.
Alcoholics Anonymous, big book. Yeah, this very book. Yep. Mm-hmm. You can, I mean, it's falling apart. It's warped from when I spilt a tall boy on it. Because back in 2016, I was smoking crack and drinking a tall boy and reading it, and I burnt my finger and spilt it on the...
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
So it, you've said some things now that make me think that you have had experience in the program, like before you got sober, like you were going to meetings and you were, I mean, you just said you're smoking crack and reading the big book. So there were definitely attempts made before you found this way, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't say that I'm specifically a member of any fellowship because I don't attribute my recovery to a fellowship.
Okay.
Because I was, you know how people say they were in and out?
Yeah.
You know, I was in for 7 years, bro. I couldn't get 30 days together. Couldn't get 30 days. In those first 30 days, the only time that I would get any relief is when I was sitting with my sponsor, or I was sitting there and actually working and writing out my fourth step. The only relief I got from the withdrawals. Mm. I did my fifth step on day 25. On day 26, my sponsor came and picked me up in his 1983 mailman Jeep. And we were driving to the movie theater. He managed to go do work. And for the first time since I was 12 years old, I had no desire to drink or use. And it hasn't returned.
So I got some comments. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, known as FASD, is a developmental disorder that can impact anyone. It affects the daily lives of over 4% of Canadians, but with support and services, individuals with FASD can thrive. Learn more at saskfasdnetwork.ca. If you're interested in checking out another Canadian mental health podcaster, there's also a link for that in the show notes below. To make contact or to learn more about today's sponsors, to check out our new merch, or if you want to show us some love and buy us a coffee, all of those links are in the show notes below. Tommy
LaPlante, thanks for your comment. Says, lol, God talked through you like the talking donkey in the Bible. He talked through me once and told me he already healed me of meth. I was sketched. It was an anointing. I still had cravings too.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was saying is, like, if you're struggling right now, it's not about one of those one experiences. And that's why I try to make it clear, like, because not everybody has an experience where they meet Jesus, you know, across from them.
It's in a diner.
It happens more than you would think. You know, it's not like some rare occurrence, but I don't want people to think that they need that to get in recovery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the only relief I got was through the 12 steps. Not from going to meetings, but from sitting down with somebody with this book and doing what it said.
Yeah.
It wasn't about a fellowship. It wasn't about meetings. It was about that man. And you know how, like, people say, like, find a sponsor who, you know, you want to be like, and you know that you have you heard that? You know, like,
I have. I've also heard people say, find a sponsor, find the person that pisses you off most in the room and make him your sponsor. That's what I heard. That was misguided. Let me tell you.
Right. Well, the man who ended up sponsoring, and I had been sponsored by, like, I was sponsored by a celebrity that you would know. Can't say who it is, but couldn't get me sober. Uh-huh. I was sponsored by multiple people that were Mr. King fellowship, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is that I was putting it on them. Mm-hmm. You can't put it on anybody to get you sober. The man who got me through the work had never used a drug in his life, had only drank. He was coming up on 2 years sober when he sponsored me, had never sponsored anybody before, and he was a gay man. Here's this person that I basically don't have anything in common with, except for the disease. It's not about finding the sponsor that has the nicest truck or the hottest wife or the most, you know, the things of the world that you want to get. That is the worst thing to look for in a sponsor. Because you want them to have the time for you, because your life depends on doing the work. And these fellowships that are saying, you know, we meet, you know, once a week and we do a step a month, you know, for someone like me, I'm dying.
Yeah.
I'm dying. That's going to kill me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't
that
work.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that is such a valid and integral point that you just made, you know, that You need to ensure that the person has time. I don't think people, when they go out looking for a sponsor, really take that into consideration. So I'm really glad that you articulated that.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, to me, I mean, those meetings, like a meeting where we do a step a month, I mean, I can see that being good for someone who's got some footing, you know, who's got a foundation somewhat built that totally. They can build this. You know what I mean? So like, I really resonate with that because I don't know if you're like me, but like, I'm all or nothing. Like if I'm doing something, I'm all the way doing it. Donna hates it sometimes. I get on this mission, like, and it works good sometimes. Cause like today we're moving, I got a pile of work done, but yeah, if someone said, okay, we're only going to do one step a month, like, I don't know if I would have been able to align with that.
Yeah. I mean, you're telling me that we're not going to meet for a week and I have to, in between that week, not use? Like, I can't, you know, and you've heard those people that say, you know, go to a meeting every day and just don't use between meetings, no matter what.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No matter what between meetings I was using.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time.
I love the sarcastic arm. No matter what.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also real careful to make sure that this is not a knock on anyone, any fellowship. If it weren't for the fellowships, I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. Right. If it weren't for the people that got sober before me, I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's, as long as somebody is a real addict or alcoholic and they have found a program that works for them, I'm all for it. But the people that are coming into the fellowships to find friends, and if, hey, I just don't have to drink. Well, I chose not to drink today. So let's, you know, let's go to AA or let's go to NA.
Yeah.
Right. Because they want a social club. But the thing is that those same people in the meetings that are sharing how they woke up and chose not to drink today, their message is killing people like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't understand what's wrong with me.
Because I can't choose that.
Why can't I choose that?
Yeah. So what did it look like for you then in the first 6 months of your recovery? Did you find a meeting every day? Did you said you had experience with Jesus. Did you jump into the Bible? Did you go to church? What did that look like for you? How'd you make it through?
All the above, bro. I just, you know, I was going to meetings. I was up in Montana and, you know, the change in me was apparent quickly because, you know, when you're working the steps that rapidly, I did the fifth step on day 25. I was making amends within the first 40 days, you know?
Whoa.
And when you do the work like that, the change happens. I legitimately had no desire to drink or use on day 26. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you know, I was able to talk to my probation officer because during this whole time I'm homeless and stuff, I would randomly go into my probation officer high out of my mind, asking him to put me in prison because I can't stop using, you know? Yeah. And then he sees this change in me, and change can happen quickly. I think that if someone is struggling, you have to be willing to do an incredible amount of work. Really, it can happen quickly, but an incredible amount of work to change all of these things in your life. It's not about taking your time. It's not a race. I heard that when I was looking for a sponsor, guys with 27 years were saying, slow down. It's not a race. I'm like, thank you for your time, but I know I need to do the steps.
And it is kind of a race.
100%, bro.
Yeah.
100%.
Wow.
In the US, there's 100,000 plus dying every single year now.
Yeah.
How is that okay? Tell those people that are sick in withdrawal from fentanyl, telling them, yeah, just sit with your feelings, bro. No. Mm-hmm. There is this thing, and people just need to work it. And we got to tell them that.
Yeah.
I worked really hard to be here.
Yeah. Hmm. So you made this big change, and in 40 days, you're seeing results. or at least the people around you are seeing results. When did the rubber really start to hit the road for you? Do you remember when that, like, was it a moment? And I know we all have moments and we all have new awakenings and we all have new veils dropping as we grow in our recovery and coping with the human condition. But tell us the first time that you were able to actually take a breath and know that it's going to be okay. Was there a circumstance around that? Did you get through your step four? Did you make a powerful amend? Like, tell us about some of the times that were really pinnacle for you.
Yeah, it was definitely when I did the fifth step. And on day 26, it was as if my mind was going this way the day before, to where I don't know how I'm going to make it another day. I just have to sit down and do this work. Mm-hmm. To then all of a sudden I woke up and I had no desire to drink or use. It was gone. You know?
What'd you do?
And then, what's that?
So what'd you do then with that day that you didn't want to drink and use?
Bro, that day, I knew it was my purpose to help as many people as possible find that feeling, because I did not think that it was available. I didn't think I was ever going to feel like that. I didn't know what it was like. And it was such a change that it was obvious. This happened. I wanted to use, now I don't. On day 30, I still have the journal from this day too. And I'm journaling to God and I'm like, God, I can't believe I made it 30 days. Like, I made it, like, you know, cause I'm stoked. Mm-hmm. And I was like, God, it would be amazing if I didn't smoke a cigarette today. I want to show people that you can quit drinking and using and smoking and to go back. And I haven't had a drag of a cigarette since day 30. 7 days later, after quitting a pack a day smoking habit, I hopped on a treadmill and ran a mile in 7 minutes and 18 seconds.
Whoa.
And the whole time I'm doing that, I'm staring at myself in the mirror and I'm learning how to depend on God, bro. I'm looking at myself, but I'm saying God can do this. And during the pandemic, I ran a mile in 5 minutes and 57 seconds. And guess what? Yeah. I hate running. I hate it.
I used to live along the river and I'd watch people jogging by and I was out there smoking my cigarettes and, you know, having my coffee and watching all these people. And there's, you know, it's like, does anybody actually enjoy running? Like, for real? Does anybody actually like it?
You're the one smoking and you're the one feeling like the smart person on the street.
What's wrong with you people?
Yeah.
Calm down.
So where'd you go from there?
You've heard, obviously, everybody's heard that it's a program of progress and not perfection, right?
Yeah.
I have not worked on relapse prevention at all. Like, I don't think about using. I don't think about drugs. Mm-hmm. I constantly think about how can I help the next. And I wake up thinking about that. I'm my for-profit company and my nonprofit company both do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And what I found, and the interesting thing, I want to make this clear, both companies are not my recovery. I have sponsees that I meet with daily, mm-hmm. and that has nothing to do with Recovered on Purpose or the drug rehab agency. Neither one. And you have, and this is something that a mentor told me, that you always, no matter what you're doing, no matter, you know, what happens in your life, you've got to keep a couple knuckleheads that you're sponsoring. And he uses that word because it's true, you know?
Yeah.
When you have to remember where you came from and how you felt. And there's such a spiritual experience when somebody that doesn't think that they're going to be able to get clean has that spiritual awakening right in front of you. Mm-hmm. There is no dope better than that.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about then the experience you had with your friend that he took his own life right after the phone call with you. Did that come bubbling up in a big way earlier in your recovery?
I wouldn't say that it did. I think that what happened was it came up when I wrote my book.
Okay.
I wrote and published my book, From Chains to Saved, for my 2 years clean and sober. Mm-hmm. And while I was writing that book, I relived everything. And I did it in a really cool way, though. I don't believe in triggers. You know, life is a trigger in addiction. I would opening my eyes, I needed dope, right? And I think that it's disempowering to talk about triggers, because there's going to be triggers every single day that I can look at and be like, oh, yep, I'm going to use, that sucks. But in reality, it's life. Nothing has that power over me anymore. And with the story with Chuck, there's some really interesting things that happened. Exactly 11 years later, on September 28th of 2019, is when I heard that same voice whisper in my heart, if you publish your book for your 2 years clean and sober, you're going to inspire so many others to do the same. And I was like, my 2 years, that's in 5 weeks. So I go home, and at the time I have 23 employees, and I had to let the managers know, like, hey guys, I got to take a couple weeks. You know, I'm writing a book and I need your help. Okay. And then I sat down, bro. And for the first couple days, I knew I wasn't going to be able to just like sit down and write a book and like, it's just going to come out right. So you see this whiteboard behind me, I had whiteboards around me, and I dumped out everything on a whiteboard from my life, every single story I could think of in 5 words or less. And then I decided what I wanted my book to be about. I wanted it to be about all my spiritual experiences that I've had through my addiction and what, you know, happened in and before, and then how I got sober through spiritual means and things like that. And then I took all those and I put them over on this whiteboard. And then I mapped them together chronologically. And then I made a checklist. And then I just wrote every single one down. What I didn't realize is that that process was going to be, it was going to become the way that I coach people in recovery to write and publish books. Wow. And that's how I teach people. It's like a blueprint, bro, for how we can share a recovery story as a message instead of a war story.
And this was something that just came to you? That wasn't something that you learned somewhere?
Part of it was definitely something that I learned. You know, it was a mind map, but the mind dump, I call it a mind dump story vault. That was something that God gave me. The mind map was something that I learned in a course. Everybody knows about mind mapping, but putting them together, but then there was this category thing that I did. So in the mind dump, I would categorize them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1 being before addiction, like before you even started to use drugs or anything. There's some stories from childhood you might need to share to get people to relate. 2 is the start, like where you started using, you're having fun, you're partying, that kind of stuff. And then 3 is the bad addiction, right? The time, the war stories. Those are important to tell in your story because only addicts understand the real war stories, right? Mm-hmm. And then 4 is the whole process of recovery. How did you recover? And then 5 is after, like the life in recovery, the way that things are going now, the life you have now, like what is going to inspire somebody to actually want to find recovery? Mm-hmm. And the point of telling our stories, and you know, the 12 steps is what saved my life, right? Yeah. Jesus and the 12 steps. There's people getting in recovery with a whole bunch of other means, right?
Yeah.
Not everybody has the same faith I have. There's people using Suboxone for a couple years, and I'm 100% pro anything that is saving lives, right? And all of these stories are important for somebody. If you're in recovery, there is somebody out there right now who has to hear your story to recover.
Beautiful. Speaking of war stories, I nearly forgot. We have a video here. Before we get too far away from it, tell us a little bit about this video before, like, tell us what led up to this video before we play it.
So that is November 6th of 2015, exactly 2 years before I got sober. I was in Montana. I was knocking doors, working, and I went over to my then girlfriend's house, and I was kind of hiding that I was still using from her. And I left. I said, I'm going to go back to the hotel, go to bed. And I went around the corner and I shot up. And the next thing I knew was this video.
Here we go.
Hey. Hey. Hey.
Wow.
So let's follow this up with a comment. Tommy
says, wow, no relapse prevention, no triggers. How does someone who has triggers relate? I'm pro anything that saves lives too. Great message.
Thanks, Tommy. And I don't look at things as triggers. I'm not going to give something the power to trigger me to go use. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to do it. Mm-hmm. When I don't use that language, of course, I have extremely hard days in recovery. Extremely hard days. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to look at something that happens as something that's going to make me use. Because if I allow anything to be there, then something is there.
So you don't believe that they're in triggers in any capacity, or just you don't believe in something that something can trigger you to use?
Yeah, that's the language that I'm talking about. Triggering me to use.
Okay. Yeah. Because I mean, I get triggered. My kids trigger me all the time.
Totally.
I was like, this guy, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just the language for me, because sobriety is about, you know, getting to a point where we can be emotionally stable.
Yeah.
You know, when something triggers you, you pause when agitated or doubtful, and you find out if you're being dishonest, fearful, or, you know, if these things are driving you in this moment. If so, then you need to 10th step it, and then you resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Mm. You don't sit in a trigger and your emotions about this thing that happened to you, so you need to feel this way. Mm. And it's as simple, dude. I have a really amazing dog. I'm super lucky. Yeah. It's as simple as, like, Enzo needs to go for a walk.
Yeah.
That's resolutely changing your mindset to someone you can help. Bro, when I'm having a hard day, I don't go to a meeting to tell everybody how hard my day is. I go to downtown Denver and I look for someone that's out on the street suffering, and I ask them if they want to get some pizza. I go look for somebody to help, bro. Because for me, if you have addiction, the solution is helping others, period.
Yeah.
If it was about God keeps us sober, this book would be one page. This book teaches you how to connect with God and help others. Mm-hmm. That's the solution.
Yeah, if that book kept you sober, it would probably be in the basement of the Vatican under lock and key. Right. They'd make movies about it.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, Donna's over here. I when you were talking, like, I think that Donna practices that almost daily. When something is bothering her, suddenly she's cooking or she's cleaning. Yeah. Or she's like, she's providing, right? Yeah. She does that.
Yeah.
And you know, and maybe you know, that's what I do here in this studio. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to engage on social media. It's not, you know, it's not the best. Sometimes a lot of the time I on way too much. But what I'm doing is I'm helping people with my words, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can make a meme and people will privately message me saying, man, that is exactly what I needed to hear today. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I really find, like, the way that you worded it helped me kind of connect to why I am so drawn to the work that I do outside of this show. Like, I work front lines for a community-based organization, and I love it. It's hard. It's heart-wrenching. There's a couple people that come through, you know, that are, one woman in particular is like a mirror of myself. And it's just, it's astounding to see myself, you know, and she's in right around that same age range where I was when I started to come out. And now I'm in this position of trying to get through to her and help her, like, you know, find a better, safer way. But so many of her instances and experiences are just right in line with myself. And it's just, it's.
Do they trigger you?
It's triggering. Absolutely. Like hardcore triggering. But at the same time, there's some things I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to engage with her the way that I do.
So does it, I'm going to interview Donna now. So it doesn't trigger you to use though, right?
No.
So what does it trigger?
Memories.
Yeah.
And emotions.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember feeling that way and throwing my hands up in the air and screaming and crying and praying and why is this happening? And, you know, like there was something you said earlier that reminded me of a friend, I guess you could say, fellow addict who had said, you know, and this was more in relation to people who use intravenously. And it was something to the effect of, you know, the level of self-loathing a person must have to choose without choice to die the slowest, most painful death possible. You know, it just to me really illustrated just how bad we feel about ourselves when we're down there.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Adam?
Yeah. When you're talking about the memories that get brought up and stuff, what I do with Recovered on Purpose, I, you know, train people to share their stories. And, you know, the message that I share is the unique parts of your story are there for a reason. You are beautifully and wonderfully made, unique from everybody else. But the amount of people that have hit me up specifically about suicide because of my sharing Chuck's story. Like that's the story that I share almost every time I share my story. And every single one of you listening to this right now, you have a story that someone else needs. And what's really interesting is, you know, for a while, and I can call it triggering, right? But I've heard the worst of the worst of the worst experiences from other people. Some people call it secondhand trauma, you know, but people have opened up. I've been the receiver of the first time somebody shared something many, many, many times, you know, and I had to learn how to hold that space for them and allow it to just be a thing that happened that doesn't have to come with us into the future. It doesn't, that person that hurt us back there doesn't have to have the power to hurt us now. And that's something that I had to learn myself because, dude, I've heard stories where I wanted to go find this person and kill them, you know? And thank God for God.
Like, and that is it's such a powerful thing that you just said. Like for myself, like I was in a very domestically violent relationship and some months had gone by and I found like I was triggering, I was disassociating, I was cycling, I was raging out, you know, and then all of a sudden, and I don't know if it was like a divine intervention or what it was, but something came to me and said, why are you still giving him the power? And that was such a catalyst moment for me. From that moment on, I was able to move forward in it, but it took that connection that he still had power over me, even though he was not even within my orbit. And I was like, okay, enough is enough. Time to move forward.
That's good. How'd you move forward?
I connected with meditation and I did some hypnosis, like self-hypnosis and stuff like that. I was very low income and I was very pregnant. So I had to lean on a lot of community-based organizations and outreach workers. And I was incredibly blessed to have some of the most wonderful human beings help me through and point me in the right direction. But a lot of it was self-directed.
When you started to talk about like, this is enough, right? He's not coming with me anymore. There was a decision that you made there.
Absolutely. There was, you know, and like, I remember in times when, you know, when I was still in that life, like I was like, you're not going to fucking break me, you know, fuck you. And then that would anger him, you know, like I get, you know, you're going to break you like the dog that you are and all that kind of stuff. But I had this resolve that I was like, no, like, fuck you. And then here on this other side of it, when he wasn't even in my orbit, and I was letting him control me mentally, you know, it was just this like, you were so fucking stubborn back then. Where'd that stubbornness go? It's like, what happened, girl? Like, get your shit together and get up and get going.
So again, you're using language with yourself that's really interesting that I want to point out. You're saying you were letting him. Mm-hmm. You were letting him. Mm-hmm. You made a decision. You know, decision means to cut something off. It comes from, you know, the root of incision, to cut something off, right? Oh. You're no longer letting this come with you. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to show people about triggers. You can be an overcompassing way that you think. Mm-hmm. Nothing is going to trigger me to react in a way that is not with who I am. If it's not mm-hmm. in line with who I am, I've made the decision not to act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Barb, what's going on? Barb says, harness the power of stubborn. Thanks for showing up,
yeah.
Barb.
Yeah, thanks, Barb.
So, what else? Tell us about what you're up to, man. Tell us how you're helping people.
Yeah, I get to, I'm really, really lucky and blessed, you know, and there's, I don't know how much of it was a choice, but it was definitely a decision to work on Recovered on Purpose to, you know, I built a course. I like to say it's a real dope course because, you know, I worked really hard on it, had a producer produce it and everything, but it teaches the whole method. And I have worksheets in it. And I'm actually about to be able to put the whole thing on my website and give out free logins, you know? So I'm working on that over the next month so that people can learn how to share their story from the blueprint that I told you about. You can write a book from it. Courtney launched hers in February. Chase is getting ready to publish his over the next month. He came to our call this week and had his manuscript finished. So, and that's a big deal. When you get your first draft finished, you have a book that now you just have to edit. You know, so I get those things with the nonprofit side. Really cool is on the for-profit side, I'm working with an agency. I'm the director of marketing for the drug rehab agency. And we're the top agency for consulting to open rehabs, to market for rehabs, to help rehabs merger and do acquisitions and things like that in the space. And I get to help. Congruent messaging is everything that I do with my marketing strategy. I think that there's a lot in the industry that I'm not the one to come in and correct it, but everything I'm doing is in line with what I believe, which is that person needs help and it's not about their insurance or their money that they have. But there's a business behind it, right? And something that I've learned is if you're a 12-step rehab, your messaging needs to be, I'm a 12-step rehab. Yes. If you're a faith-based rehab, you need to have, I'm faith-based rehab messaging. And what's an issue with the industry is there's so much broad messaging just to get that person with the insurance to our rehab, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And they are going to the wrong rehabs all the time. Mm-hmm. Last year, 80% of the insurance claims for addiction treatment were private commercial insurance. 20% were Medicaid. And the need is flipped. Less than 20% of people suffering substance use disorder have Medicaid or have private insurance. Mm-hmm. So there's something wrong with the messaging. There's not enough good resources for those that really, really need it. And that's what we're doing.
Cool.
I want to look at Tommy's comment.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your comment. Tommy says, trauma addicts us to an inner dialogue. When I'm doing it, I tell myself it's an unhealthy thinking habit and I think a new thought. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find often, like, I will, and Dan gets mad at me because I very rarely, like, verbalize things because I'm at war in my head because, like, something will bubble up and I'll start having this, like, nope, that's, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. But I'll give off all this weird energy. And so Dan, of course, you know, we've been together for, like, ever. So he knows. He's like, what's going on? You know, but so, yeah. Like, because, like, I used to get caught in those negative talk, like, loops, and I would spit something out that I'd regret. You know, so yeah, it's really important to be aware of your thinking mm-hmm. and then catch yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we'll cap it there. Adam, is there anything that you'd like to leave us with tonight?
Yeah. Again, your story matters and it's not over. It is not over. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go to recoveredonpurpose.org, I've got a bunch of free resources on there. I know I talk about, I don't do relapse prevention, but I have a free relapse prevention worksheet on there that you can fill out on your phone, you can fill out right on your tablet. Well, the thing is I don't believe in focusing on all the things we need to avoid in life.
Yeah.
We have to focus on all the things we can do.
Yeah.
Like there's so much to do in life. You know, we don't have to hide from all these things. We need to focus on all the things we want to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the sheet. It's mm-hmm. figuring out, okay, this is what my life was like. This is where I want it to go. And then it's got like 111 positive affirmations that will retrain your brain. You know, I've got my book on there for free also. You can get it digital and audio. And then we have resources in all 50 states. And nothing on that website earns any money for anybody involved with it. So it's all for addicts.
Wow.
recoveredonpurpose.org.
Thanks so much for joining us, Adam. I think
incredible,
that was a great,
Adam.
Yeah, that was a great talk.
Thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time and reaching out mm-hmm. and getting your butt in the chair in front of us here. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much, man. Take care.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you guys.
Good night, everyone.
Okay, if you got anything out of that, please hit that like button at the bottom of the screen. If you're not yet subscribed, please hit that subscribe button. Every engagement helps. Leave us a comment. Tell us your thoughts. If you got a story idea or if you want to get on the show or you know someone who does or whatever, Daniel, hardknockstalks.com. Reach out and say hello. I'd love to hear from you. That's all I got for you tonight. Take care, everyone.
Say, this is Hard Knocks Talks.